Coming to you from a barn that's definitely a barn and not anything alive at all, ever, it's The Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Hello, everyone. I am Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa.
And I'm Jared Anderson.
Hi, Jared Anderson.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's so good to have you. So Jared is a podcaster. His show is called The Crypto Naturalist. It's one of my personal favorites, as well as an author. And we're really excited to have you here.
Yeah, if you listen to The Crypto Naturalist, you might be expecting me to sound a little more like this. But I'm not going to do that for the show so that nobody laughs the whole time. What can I say about me? I'm a podcaster, most recently. I've been a fiction and poetry writer for a very long time. I was a biology nerd through college and still am, but I ended up with a bachelor's in English and then a master's in literature. I used to teach English for a while at the college level. I work at a wildlife rescue, and I still spend a whole bunch of time writing science fiction and fantasy, so it's a little bit about me.
Nice.
That's great. And you've come to talk a little bit about writing science fiction and fantasy, right?
Yeah, I thought that might be fun.
Can we add a section on wildlife? Because that kind of
sounds fun too. It's really not hard to get me off on another subject, so always happy to talk about wildlife.
If that's true, then it might be good to do a fun fact.
A fun fact?
Fact. So typically we divide the show into three parts, and the first one is just one of us sharing a fun fact, normally unrelated to the topic, but they can be whatever, really.
Yeah, since you bring up biology, Cleo, do you have a fun fact you'd like to share with us about a bug?
Yes, I do. I learned this recently while listening to the radio. And
they should know if anyone does.
And they should know from listening to an ad on the radio, no less.
Oh no, don't say stuff like that right after I take a drink of water.
You just stop taking a drink of water. So I was listening to an ad on the radio, and I heard a fact about cockroaches that I was like, this cannot be true. So I Googled it. Because if the radio's wrong, the internet's going to be right.
For sure.
And so we all know cockroaches are tough bugs. I think I've heard them described as, you know, one of the few things that will survive a nuclear holocaust. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, not only can they survive a nuclear holocaust, they can survive up to a week without their heads.
What? I've heard this.
Is that true?
It's true. It's true.
Is that a thing that happens often?
I don't know if it actually happens often. It's just a thing that can happen. Apparently, they've done science experiments where if you cut off their heads and keep them refrigerated, they can even survive several weeks.
And that's the origin. That's the origin of the Sleepy Hollow myth. All right.
I hate it so much.
Not many people knew that the Headless Horseman was actually also a cockroach.
Yep, it all makes sense
now. Oh, no. There are a few things that seriously do bug me, and one of them is cockroaches.
Yeah, was that a pun, Rissa?
Yes.
They bug you?
I learned a fun fact this week that I did not know.
Oh, would you like to share?
Yeah, I learned that alligators and crocodiles are actually closer related to birds than to lizards.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Isn't that bizarre? Yeah, they're from... It has to do with their bone structure and the formations of their skulls. They go back to being a relation closer to dinosaurs than modern reptiles. And in that lineage, they're still closer to birds than they are to lizards.
Whoa.
Yeah. Mind blown.
This explains so much about alligators.
It's good to know that dinosaurs still walk the earth. That is comforting to me personally.
I wonder where in that spectrum something like a Komodo dragon would lie.
I'm not sure. I think they're closer to modern reptiles.
I just find Komodo dragons super interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the bacterial bite is my favorite part of the Komodo dragons. Yeah.
I remember watching, I think it was a show once about how they were trying to develop a medicine to treat these bites, and that the only ingredient that they could really find that had any effect whatsoever was dragon blood. Komodo dragon blood.
Yeah,
of
that
course.
Sounds
but it
so
sounds
made
cooler
up. Yeah.
When you're taking dragon blood.
That sounds like a solution that would come from a wizard.
Right?
Rissa.
Yeah.
Rissa, who would win in a fight between a cockroach and a Komodo dragon?
I mean, Komodo dragons are significantly bigger and would just eat the cockroach, so.
Yeah, the Komodo dragon would digest it.
This is a bad comparison.
What if the cockroach got away? Would it die from Komodo dragon venom?
Get back on topic, please.
Oh, gosh. So, yeah, let's move into our colloquium. So what have you come onto the show to tell us about today, Jared?
Well, I've spent a long time attending science fiction, fantasy writing conventions, and I've just noticed that a very popular topic is how to get into publishing in the first place. So how to start selling fiction and poetry to markets that will actually pay you. And
nice.
I thought that was appropriate with your Somebody Pay Us intro. So
that is something that I'm personally very interested in, and I've been writing a long time too, so.
Yeah, so this is a way to get paid a little bit for the liberal arts. But, you know, I have found that a lot of people don't know where to begin. So I thought it might be fun to talk a little bit about how to figure out what markets you can sell to and how to go about doing that.
When did you start writing, Jared?
Ooh, I think I was about 8. I have a poetry contest award from 5th grade here that I still have in my keepsake book. So, yeah,
awesome.
I've been at it a while.
That's great.
Yeah, you might be shocked to hear that I mostly wrote poetry about trees when I first started. So,
always a good topic.
Yeah, some things haven't changed.
Following in the fine traditions of J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah, exactly. Trees and walking, the J.R.R. Tolkien tradition. Yeah, so, you know, eventually you write for long enough, you think, okay, well, these are great in my desk drawer, but it might be nice if somebody wanted to read this eventually. I think it's interesting to then figure out where to place some of the poetry and fiction you write. So the general way to do it is to start looking around, but that's all well and good. If you're talking about Google, it can be a little bit daunting. So there are a couple of resources that I always recommend for people. One of them is called Duotrope, Duotrope. And that basically lets you search markets that buy fiction or poetry by the length, the topic, the kind of poetry or fiction you write. And then it gives you a lot of details about how to submit your work, what they pay, stuff like that. That one is a subscription service. So that one's like $5 a month. So, but there's also a free one called Raylan.com, Raylan.com. And again, you just start to research what markets are out there based on the subjects you write. And then, you know, you go to the markets and you start to read what they publish and see if it's similar to what you're doing. And then from there, it's kind of a tedious process of following directions. So I've actually started accepting submissions for the Hidden Lore segment on my podcast. So, and I used to be a reader for a couple literary journals back when I was at Ohio University. So one of the main things you'd see is that people who would send you poetry or fiction, but that clearly didn't read the instructions. So, yeah.
The favorite thing.
Yeah.
The best thing.
Yeah, it shouldn't be hard, but apparently it is. So... The good news about that, though, is that if you then follow the pretty arbitrary guidelines the editor set out, then you already have a leg up on your competition.
This is really encouraging, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, so that part's not hard. I think what can be frustrating is, you know, you got to be pretty thick-skinned about rejections. Yeah. So if you want to publish for money, you kind of have to produce and produce and produce and then not be terribly sensitive about getting rejections. Because, you know, there are a million different reasons you might have been rejected. So you just kind of can't take that to heart. So what I often do is, say I wrote a short story. I'll find the three or four markets I think are most appropriate, send it out. If those get rejected, then I might kind of go down a tier on the respectability level.
Lower your own standards.
Lower those standards. And then if those get rejected, you do it again. And, you know, if it doesn't work out, you retire the piece. But you just kind of keep producing and keep trying. Yeah. And eventually, you know, you start to get some publishing credits to put in your cover letter. And then I think it makes it a little easier to sell fiction and poetry once you have a few publications under your belt. But it's that process of just collecting those, you know, hundreds of rejections before you actually start to get some good publications.
Sounds like doing grad school applications for the rest of your life.
Yes, oh, no. Yes. Except you don't have to take the GRE and no one charges you to do these things.
See, that's really nice.
That's one advantage, yeah.
If you have to pay to submit a piece, then you are being scammed.
In my humble opinion, yes.
Good to know.
So a lot of literary journals, not a lot, but some of the more literary journals have taken to charging you to submit. I would never do that. That doesn't make any sense. You know, if a publication is viable, it should be making its money from advertisers, from readers, not from the writers that are submitting works. So yeah, don't ever submit to a place that tries to charge you for just reading your stuff, in my humble opinion.
I'm going to send so many letters to all the universities that rejected me now.
Dear
University of Michigan, you are a scam.
Well, I mean, it drives me a little crazy because I came from that world. So I used to do literary poetry and fiction. And, you know, even if I got something published in a literary magazine, and I have a handful of times, you know, that was it. I didn't get paid. I didn't get reader feedback. You know, when I publish something in Asimov's, you know, they send me a couple $100 check, and then I often will get letters from people who have read what I wrote. So it's a lot more like an actual conversation with an actual audience. Mm-hmm. I am pretty biased against literary fiction.
In the scant writing that I have done, I like thrive on reader feedback sometimes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of lonely work to write something. So to actually get some feedback from somebody reading it is very encouraging. So you said you were writing. Have you started to try to look at publication yet?
Not really. Part of it is I am terrified. Part of it is I haven't written anything but a podcast for a while that would be publishable.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, I've written fan fiction, but like, I mean, I can just publish that anywhere, whatever.
Well, yeah, that's like the other part of this, right? Like, it's the philosophical question of like, what do you want to do this for? Like, I think it's perfectly cool to just write and publish fan fiction. Like, that's a legitimate thing to do with your creative time and talents. If you're trying to, like, publish in magazines, that's kind of a different animal, and that's more what I was just describing. If you want to publish novels, that's an entirely different subject, right?
Right.
Like, anybody can self-publish now on Amazon, and that's perfectly cool if that's what you want to do, but then if you want to go the more traditional route, then again, it's layers upon layers of gatekeepers. So, you know, you write, you finish your novel, and then you start querying agents. And what you're querying for is you're telling them about your book and asking permission to send them the entire book.
Seems very like, how do you as a writer get past the imposter syndrome part of that? Like, my book can't possibly be good enough yet.
I think it's thinking that I will never run out of ideas. Like, so I think like I'm never going to run out of things to write about. I'm never going to run out of ideas. There will always be the next book. So you finish a book, you start sending it out, and you sure hope an agent is interested in it, but you realize that if it's not this book, it'll be the next book. So I think a big part of being a writer that wants to do that kind of thing is the idea that, look, I would write every day even if I wasn't trying to do this. So you just kind of keep that engine chugging, and that lets you kind of shrug off some of the rejections a little bit. Because a lot of people tried to publish 4 or 5 books before they get one, you know? That's just true.
Would you tell us about the first piece that you got published? Or was that your 5th grade poem?
That was published. Well, it's tough. You know, I remember the first poem in college I was really excited about was it was in San Francisco's university's press. I think it was called 14 Hills. So I was really excited because that was a big national, you know, university press. But I don't think I was as excited about that as when I started to get some professional publishing credits in, you know, Daily Science Fiction or Apex or Asimov's. Because I think that was me kind of letting go of my university pretensions and starting to write more of the kind of stuff I wanted to read, which I think is a big part of how you, I don't know, of how you become a successful writer or podcaster, or of really dialing in on sort of who you are and what you want to write rather than writing the kind of things you think maybe you're supposed to, if that makes sense. Like, I think I was a little too preoccupied with being literary when I first started out. And that's great, but, like, that's not what I read for fun, so.
Does anyone read literary work for fun? I'm not talking about academia there, Cleo, because I know that you read Rick-like history books for funsies, but.
I also tend to, anyway. I think this you is just you, scientist.
No, no.
I think this is just you.
I mean, so I read Moby Dick about once a year. Poetry. So, like, there are books I read a lot that are considered literary works, but I often think that they were unfairly stolen by literature. Like, Moby Dick, what is Moby Dick about? It's about a huge supernatural whale that destroys ships and has a vendetta against one crazy guy with a lightning-shaped scar on his face. Like, okay, academia, sure, this is capital L literature. What they do is they just steal any science fiction or fantasy that they like and call it literature. Mm-hmm. You know, something
Can
similar.
Can you have another example of that?
Well, yeah. How about Jeff Vandermeer recently? He wrote the Southern Reach trilogy. Annihilation was just a movie that came out based on the first book. So he was always sort of an odd science fiction fantasy writer. And that's where his books appeared when they first came out, but then they got a lot of critical praise, and now suddenly I see Jeff Vandermeer's Southern Reach trilogy appearing in the literature section of bookstores.
Huh.
Like, why? Well, because they got a bunch of critical acclaim, you know, and started winning awards, and so now they're literature. Well, how useful is that, you know?
So, when you say literature, what do you mean by that?
Well, that's a fair question, and it's a foggy term, right? Because, you know, there are lots of university classes now on Dracula and Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
Are those literature? Like, and who gets to say that? It's really kind of what academia and the literary community has decided can be part of the canon. So that can be kind of arbitrary and exclusionary. I mean, so, you know, most of who they decide can be part of the literary canon have traditionally been, you know, old white guys. And then certain topics have been taboo. And then suddenly they'll let Frankenstein in or Moby Dick, you know. So it's pretty arbitrary. But something I like to argue these days are things that are being published now that are shooting for literary work. I'm pretty biased. I'm upfront about my bias, but I feel like they're not as alive and don't have the readership of genre fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of science fiction and fantasy and horror. So I kind of think that in 30 years, a lot of what is considered science fiction and fantasy and horror will be studied in a university setting. It's just not there now.
Do you think that's more true now than before? Because there's always been pop fiction.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's been a part of the process for a long time. I mean, Shakespeare was for the groundlings, right? It was for the drunk people eating peanuts standing on a dirt floor. And now, you know, it is the snootiest of snooty. Yeah.
The Bodleian Library at Oxford University has recently acquired a complete set of first edition Shakespeare stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When they were first published for the first time, the library was offered a free copy, and they said, "No, we don't want your drivel. That's in English.
Yeah.
We don't need any of your stupid English plays. We only accept books in Latin."
Yeah, exactly.
And years later, they were like, "We finally have it." So I think it's
you can go back a few more. You can go back a few more hundred years before that, when the Bible wasn't allowed to be translated into Latin because that was too common. So a Latin Bible was called was called the Vulgate, as in vulgar, because, you know, everybody can read Latin. Why aren't you reading it in the original Greek? So, like, I think that's a continuous process of people being like, people who are the gatekeepers kind of being snooty and exclusionary. And then, you know, 30 years later, it's the stuff that really spoke to the people, the popular stuff, that is what is studied, because that's really what's representative of a time and a place and a people, the popular stuff. Plus, if nobody wants to buy it, it doesn't survive because they don't print that many copies of it. Yes. You know, if nobody cares about it at the time, then it's not around 100 years later for anybody to study.
My gosh, what are we sending into the future? I'm scared.
Well, this is actually something that's really interesting to me. I've written on the I have a degrees in philosophy, and I've written about video games. And the interesting thing there is all of them are still in this early popular media thing, but then you have the additional thing of like, in the future, will I even be able to encounter this?
Sure.
Will I always be able to encounter the Ocarina of Time if we don't update it to play on something other than a 64, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to be a growing industry, is figuring out how to like archive video games so that, you know, we chronicle them and they're still around, because I think they're a really interesting narrative form that people are telling really cool stories with. But
oh my god, we've got a use for nostalgia culture.
Yes, save these games, we're going to be studying them later. But, you know, man, I've seen professors in classrooms get angry at the idea of video games as literature.
Like I said, as someone who's written, like, that was my master's thesis, and everyone I encountered in university was like, I'm sorry?
Yes. So
what?
So what's up with that? Why do you think people in universities can't see, you know, it's like they all study the history of the constant changes in artistic movements, and yet anytime somebody challenges what's already on the table, it gets met with so much, I don't know, conservatism, you know, so much resistance. I don't know why.
One thing from experience, the only thing I could point to, people weren't always startled that I was studying video games as if they were literature. What they were startled by was that I was taking a literary view of video games. And what I mean by that is, when I said I'm a philosopher writing on video games, everyone I encountered assumed I was writing on ethics.
Oh.
They assumed I was writing about the evils of video games. Oh, and geez. That was very prevalent. And I wasn't. But I wonder if that has a great deal to do with it, that because people haven't really firmly decided that video games aren't evil, they don't want to consider them as art.
Yeah. I remember getting sort of harassed by teachers. You know, I'd be complimented on my vocabulary in you know, middle school, and they'd say, "Oh, you must read a lot." And it's like, "Yeah, I got a lot of my vocabulary from video games, though."
Yeah.
You know, the old 2D RPGs like Baldur's Gate, and you know,
yeah,
all of those things.
Baldur's Gate has a very good vocabulary.
Yeah, it does. I mean, and you know, there's a lot of reading there too. So
yeah.
But teachers didn't like to hear that.
These dang millennials reading the Bible in Vulgate. Who do they think they are?
Right.
Learn the Aramaic.
It's another version of the should you let your kids read comic books.
Oh, yeah.
Because those aren't real books, and they're not actually learning anything.
I mean, that's what they said about novels when, like, Jane Eyre and stuff was being written, so.
Yep. I mean, there was a time in Renaissance culture where they called poetry, they had a word for it. It was like juvenilia. It was like something you did when you were young before you grew up.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just a human nature thing to be really distrustful of anything that's new, either in terms of art or even technology. I used to, I've read a hilarious article about how pencils were going to bring down civilization because people were going to be very careless now that they could just erase things that they wrote.
I read something, I don't know how true this is, but the first man who went
to France with and walked the streets with an umbrella, got things thrown at him.
Oh, well, he's practically a space alien.
That is so stupid. Look at him walking the streets with that thing over his head.
What?
How dare you defy God's reign? Cyborg, be gone. Yeah. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, that's just people. But I think what's encouraging about that is, like, if you're doing something that people think is weird or, you know, unusual, it's like, okay, well, you're probably who's going to be relevant in 40 years, because that's always what the cycle is.
Mm-hmm.
So podcast, yay.
Yay. I had a question. I heard someone have a question.
Oh, yeah. No, I was just going to ask, because you said you, you know, worked in universities before, can I assume that you've published, you talked about poetry and like fiction and stuff. Have you published kind of nonfiction academia work as well?
I'm afraid I was just
wondering if you could compare those two.
Oh man. Yes. And, it's hard to compare them. I went back and read a thing I published, about, what was it? It was The Nature of Knowledge in Paradise Lost.
Nice.
And like I'm rereading it and it was just like, ugh. Like I still agree with my argument, but just like the level of prose where I just kind of felt like I had a thesaurus open in front of me at all times.
Do you think they're really different in the publication process though?
Yes and no. I mean, yes in that it's knowing your market and being strategic about what you're writing and who you're sending it to based on an understanding of what they publish and their readership. No, in that I don't think anybody has read that article I wrote on on Milton. And I think a whole bunch more people listen to my podcast or have read, you know, my science fiction stories. So
right.
It's just so niche right now. Like, I'm not saying this about science. Science, peer-reviewed journals and science are a different animal. But in letters and literature, I think, like, ooh, publishing in some of those journals feels like, you know, printing something out and just putting it under a rock somewhere.
Yeah.
It's a bit like I've had friends talk about writing their thesis, and it's just like, I know that no one's going to ever read this.
Yeah.
And, you know, unlike an article where you, you know, you're in an archive of some kind where you can search for, oh, you know, educational tactics in teaching analytical chemistry and someone would read an article about that, but a thesis on it, not necessarily.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, that was one of the things that kind of drove me out of academic writing and academia in general, was sort of that sense of, it's like, okay, I'm talking to a group of 10 other scholars that know what I'm talking about. And you know, that can be a little isolating sometimes, especially when you're talking about literature, you know, because it increasingly bothered me the idea that literature is supposed to be something that's alive and discussed and, you know, provokes conversation. So I wanted to be talking to a wider audience, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
I often wander through large libraries and wonder, how many of these books have ever actually been read?
Yeah.
Especially university libraries where things get donated.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I know some library scientists that I think would tell you that they do get purged every so often, depending on how often they're checked out. But even then, like, academic libraries have kind of an artificiality to them, because a lot of the reasons people check them out are for specific assignments on topics that they don't really have a lot of interest in, you know?
No, the library at the school I went to was it was one of the 5 legal libraries in the UK, so they have to keep everything they're given given everything. It's basically like the Library of Congress. They're given everything that is published in that country.
Yeah.
And they just have miles and miles of stuff no one will ever read. And most of it doesn't make it to the public spaces where I was walking, but a lot of the works felt that way, you know?
Yeah.
No, do self-published books end up in the Library of Congress?
I don't think so. I think you can request anything to be in the Library of Congress, or at least cataloged there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. If you're a library scientist and you're listening to this, we'd love to know the answer to that question.
I could ask my sister, as my sister has a master's in library science.
Yeah. Yeah, that would do it.
Maggie. If only we were a library scientist.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about self-publishing. I think it's... I self-published... my wife and I wrote a book of science fiction prompts once, and then we self-published it for as little as Amazon would let us publish it for. I think it was like 99 cents or something. Because we thought it would be fun, and it was a question we got a lot at conferences. So we did that, and it was number one on the writing prompt book list forever. So that was really cool, and that led us to getting a publishing deal with Sterling Press, which is Barnes & Noble's publishing wing.
Yeah.
And then they eventually paid us to write a book of science fiction prompts. So like that was a thing that self-publishing did that was cool.
Right.
But, I mean, the only negative thing I can say about it as a reader is that I tend to steer clear of self-published books because I know they didn't have to go through all that gatekeeping and editors.
Yes.
Which as a writer is obnoxious, and as a reader is like, okay, thank you for doing some of this work up front.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because like I only have so many hours in the day, and I don't know that I want to risk those hours on a self-published book sometimes. So it's,
yeah,
it's
that's
tough.
I've gotten a hold of some self-published books that made me want to just... I was like, I'm sorry, did you spell check this?
Yeah. Yeah.
It almost makes you think the difference between... I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and mostly I go through either Audible or LibriVox.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference is Audible, you pay money, but they're professional. LibriVox is free, but that means anyone can do it. And that means that some of them are just... really bad.
Yeah. I'm a big Audible subscriber. Most of the stuff I quote unquote read in a year is usually audiobook. So
there's
it counts.
A whole book series that I'm like, oh, I've read that. I've never touched those books,
right?
But I've listened to all of them.
Yeah. Well, my last job, I had a slightly over 3-hour commute, so I would tear through a lot of audiobooks. You know.
Yeah, you must.
Yes. Yeah, I don't have that commute anymore, so, you know, I'm doing responsible things.
One way or both ways?
No, that was both ways. It was about an hour and a half, hour and 40 minutes each
way. I was thinking you were spending 6 hours in a car, and I was like, why would you do this to yourself?
But 3 hours a day was plenty, too.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. I do that every day right now.
Oh, boy. Oh, yikes.
I listen to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, podcasts and audiobooks, yeah.
I'm very hands-on when it comes to books, so I don't actually listen to a lot of audiobooks because then I just want to, like, I want to flip the pages, so.
Oh, yeah, I get that.
Get your hand off my books, narrator.
To be honest, I started getting really into audio content because when I was in grad school, I started dealing with a lot of eye strain, and I still do, so it was like the way I could lay down and close my eyes and still have something. I didn't have to watch a screen. I didn't have to read words, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I'm just fidgety. So I like to listen to them and go for walks or drive or play video games or, you know, hike. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice combination of things. Yeah.
I still have a couple things that I because of that, have strong associations with. Like, there's this one path in the park, and there's this one tree, and I always remember, oh, when I was listening to this book, this event occurred while I was by this tree, and that kind of stuff.
Well, I always know if I'm listening to something very scary, too, because I'll have to take out one of my earbuds just so I can hear if a...
grounded where you are at.
Just to hear if a vampire is sneaking up on me. It's always good.
I actually, if I can change the subject, and I wanted to ask you about book and fiction conferences, because they're not fan conferences.
Yeah, some of them are I would describe as sort of fan conferences. Like, what's a good... There was one I used to go to here in Columbus called Context, and it was really for fans of science fiction and fantasy, but also for writers. And so there'd be panels for how to publish or you know, certain markets or certain techniques or how to write a fight scene, things like that. Nice. But then there would be other panels that were clearly just for geeking out about stuff. So most of the conferences, that's kind of a genre of conference that I really like, that'll often just kind of be science fiction, fantasy conventions. Even at like Comic-Con, usually there's a writer's track or Gen Con or, you know, some gaming conventions. If you look through what they offer, they'll be programming just for writers.
I've been to a gaming conference that was a lot like that. It was about half... here are some games you can test, mm-hmm. and the other half was exactly what you described, kind of questions about writing, questions about how to get involved in the industry, questions about this, that, and the other thing.
I mean, that's what PodCon was, too.
Okay.
And will be, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm going to go this year. I'm gonna be there in January. Yay! So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I've never been to a PodCon.
It was pretty formative in... changing the way that I thought about what we do, both on this show and then my show, the fiction show that I do. So
cool.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty hyped about it. So.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, have to say hello if I see you.
yeah, I'm gonna be wandering around looking lost, I think. So I'm still not entirely sure what I'm gonna be doing, but I'm excited to go listen to panels. Crypto Naturalist came about because. I'm like, okay, this is going to be a lot of work. I'm going to try to think about what I would just write anyway if I didn't have any pressure to write anything. And
like
so,
that.
Yeah, so like Crypto Naturalist for me is like, what do I like? I like weird nature facts. I like sort of odd fiction. And I just, I'm always willing to make something up about nature. So, or say something true. You know, it's, So far that has worked out well. Kind of, it's almost a cliche, but it's like I seem to have found the most audience when I started writing the thing that I was most interested in, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. That's kind of, to be honest, not too far off of how ours started. To be honest, this podcast started mostly as a way for us three to keep in touch on a regular basis.
Yeah,
but
sense.
It also started with the idea that basically all academics need side projects.
Mm-hmm.
Projects that we're very interested in, but we would never in a million years actually do our academic like thesis. Anyway.
Yeah, I've always said if I could just get paid to stay in school forever, I would do that.
Right?
I mean,
You're in the right place here, Jared.
Yeah.
Among friends.
Yeah, I love taking classes, you know. I just had to stop at some point and get a job and stuff.
Currently in the process of trying to figure out how to get someone to pay me to teach something to someone.
Yep, sure.
At the moment, we're at the substitute high school teacher level, so we'll see where that goes.
Yeah.
I get paid to teach English grammar to people,
which
is not something that I studied in school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
I was going to be an English professor, so I had finished my master's and realized I'd been accepted to a couple PhD programs and realized that I was going into it with like more of this. And I kind of decided, okay, clearly this isn't what I want to do. So then I just kind of taught at the instructor adjunct level for a while as I figured out what I wanted to do next, but it's tough. I mean, my feeling was, okay, I'll be an English professor because that essentially will mean I can just read anything I want and talk about it, and that'll be great. And that's like, that's kind of true, but the real job is like, here are 200 essays about legalizing marijuana. Okay, here I go. So at that point, it's like, okay, I think I'd rather work at a Starbucks and do my writing in the evening because, you know... After you've read 200 really poorly written essays on legalizing marijuana, you don't want to go home and write, you know? So that's like another thing I found is you have to find the day job that isn't so like soul sucking that I don't want to do my own stuff in the evening, you know?
Well, academia would be so good if it weren't for those pesky students.
Mm-hmm. Right? Wanting stuff and...
I'm almost the opposite. I'm in a very similar position in that I finished my master's and decided I was not about to do a PhD in this.
Yep.
And I would, I think, really love if I could do the academia bit, do the teaching, even the grading, but I didn't have to do any of the writing anymore.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Because, like, that's what intimidated me about a doctorate. It's like, I believe I have the skills required to teach, but no one will hire me to teach unless I've written a doctoral thesis. And I don't think I have the skills to write a doctoral thesis.
Okay. Yeah, I was the opposite. I'll write anything all day long, but, you know, I just was tired of looking at those students. That's not true. I like them as people, but, like, you know, it was freshman composition and stuff like that. Yeah. So
the longer murder on the old like morale.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it wasn't their fault. I just realized it wasn't for me. I partly realized that because some people are really excited to teach freshman composition, and those are the people who should be teaching it.
Yeah.
That was my experience after spending a year in middle school.
Yeah.
I was just like, there are people who have this gift, and I am not one of them.
Oh, middle
school. When I signed on to the school district, they were like, you want to teach elementary? And it was like, you don't want me to teach elementary. Like, not only do I not want this, but you don't want me to do this.
Middle school is terrifying. I feel like that's when people learn how to be mean.
Yeah.
Yes. I stopped in middle schools too, and you are completely right. And be mean to adults as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you can't be mean back.
What?
That's terrible.
That's not fair. Who invented that rule?
I mean, you can be, but you will not be asked to return.
You shouldn't be.
You can be once. Yeah. That's it.
So shall we move into what we are into this week?
Sure. Remind me what that is, though.
Sure. So this is the segment of our show where we talk about things that we in particular found exciting or interesting, and we recommend them to our listeners. Ooh, so, for example, this week I was reading Usagi Yojimbo, which is a really good comic that I love, about a rabbit who is a samurai.
Nice.
Don't worry about it. And
we did talk about that last week.
We did, in fact, talk about that last week. So I will, So, Jared, have you been reading or looking into or learning about or watching? Or I'm going to stop with the verbs. But what are you into this week?
I mean, first off, let me say that I met the artist slash writer who does Usagi Yojimbo.
You met Stan Sakai? What?
Uh-huh. He came to an event called Comics Crossroads here in Columbus. Nice. And yeah, he was at a table, and I was only slightly familiar with his work, and my wife was very familiar with his work and couldn't speak to him. So
that would be Hannah,
which I had never seen before. Let's see. What am I into?
I can go. I have one that, we didn't get to last week.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier the, like, 2D and text-based games. I've been playing a game. I was going to say a new game. It is, in fact, an old game that I have only just now discovered, called Srith, S-R-Y-T-H, that's been really fun. It's completely online. I suppose it's HTML-based. I don't think it uses Flash or anything like that. Any case, it's completely text-based, but it's a lot more... it's got a lot more mechanics than most text-based games. So, like, the classic text-based, like the Colossal Cave Adventure and Zork and stuff like that, you type in what you want to do, and there's not a ton of mechanics. You have an inventory with items, and there are special commands you learn, but most of those can be used from the beginning. This one, you pick. It's a lot like a Choose Your Own Adventure, because instead of typing it in, you pick from selected answers. Sometimes there's not very many. But more like D&D, you have not only a very long and involved inventory and, like, equipable items, but also stats and spells and lots of different stuff that you can kind of level up as you go. And it's just been really fun. It's a really fun world, and I like it because it is more like a D&D game because it has an author. Most games, I think, try to distance the creators from the created in a way. But this one is very quite upfront about the fact that this was written by a person. I don't know their name, but they're generally referred to as the GM. And they write all of this stuff. And you can really get a feel for their writing. There are certain phrases that they use a lot. because that's just how they describe things. But what's interesting about that is that it also gives them a lot of control over who your character is. You can make certain choices for your character, including some moral choices, but a lot of the choice of who your character is decided by this game master. And I don't know, it's been really interesting because it's not a personal involvement. That game master knows nothing about my character and what I think about them. But it's a really nice, it's a nice bit of writing and a really unique game. I haven't found anything else like it. It's also, for the most part, single player, which is a huge plus in my book. A lot of these become online chat room role-playing rooms, which are great, but not my thing. I've just been really enjoying it. It's also because it's online, I can play it on my phone or my computer and swap between the two rather quickly as well.
Say what the name of it is again.
Srith. I'll spell it out. It's Sryth. Cool. It's free to play, but they do have like a membership thing that unlocks more of the game. That's like, it's like $20 or something like that. It's cool. Not a lot.
That's not, I think, the best DLC.
But now they've made it like a one-time thing. But anyway, it's just been really fun. And the other good thing is because it is single player and it's text-based, it is completely non-time dependent. Mm-hmm. There are a few things that are timers that reset each day. But for the most part, you can take as long as you want. Even in the middle of a fight, you can walk away and come back tomorrow and finish it up. I think that might not be the case if you're playing free-to-play. They might have a more of a reset there. But once, if you do pay the kind of entrance fee to the, what do they call it? They call it the Adventurer's Guild. If you get in there, then it saves your stuff like whenever. So,
cool.
Yeah, it's just really creative and, like I said, interestingly personal.
Yeah, that's a really interesting mechanical setup.
Mm-hmm. I will download that.
Oh, you don't have to. You can just go online. There's no downloads.
Okay.
Even better.
Well, I'll probably give them money because I'm a sucker for that every time.
Right? I know. You find something good, you're just like, how do I pay you?
Yeah, I'm going to give you money. Okay, I have something I could recommend. I mentioned it a little earlier. I do want to recommend the Southern Reach trilogy by Jeff Vandermeer.
You said it was the same guy who wrote Annihilation, right? I've heard great things about that book.
Yeah, so that's Annihilation is the first book in the trilogy. And it was all released at the same time. And
wow.
I remember picking it up in the bookstore and almost being angry at him, at Jeff Vandermeer, because like I'm reading the first chapter standing in the bookstore and the stuff he's doing shouldn't work and feel against the rules of fiction, and yet he pulls it off. I mean, without giving away too much, in the first book, people don't have any proper names. They're called by their function in the team, the biologist, the psychologist, and it's all women.
Wow.
It's all women in this team, and the more and they have a light, and they have a little light, and it's supposed to light up if something is bad. And you know that they are on an expedition someplace strange and menacing, and you don't know why or why they're there or what is strange or menacing about the place. And as it sort of unfolds, tension builds and things get weirder and weirder. And Jeff Vandermeer, right up my alley, is very interested in nature and sort of nature going wrong. So if that sounds interesting to you, I think you'd very much like this trilogy of books, the Southern Reach trilogy.
That sounds super interesting. Yeah. I actually will have to get those. Whenever it's the school year, I get hired a lot to just proctor tests, mm-hmm. which means I'm sitting in a room with a bunch of kids. So I go through books from my library very quickly. I'll have to check and see if they have those.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah, yeah. So I highly recommend that.
I feel like I have not really read a lot of sci-fi in my life.
Mm. That's okay. Most of it is just real bad.
Well, remember, but this one has been claimed by literature, so...
I was going to say, I haven't classic. Read... I mean, I've read Frankenstein, so...
Yeah, sci-fi.
Yeah, that's all you need.
I got part of the way through Ender's Game.
Yeah, I like Ender's Game fine, but it doesn't get to be the be-all end-all of science fiction.
It's interesting. I tend to read fantasy and watch science fiction.
Yeah, me too.
I don't often do the opposite of those things.
I read a sprawling space opera called The Expanse series recently, and that was actually pretty good, and I'm not usually into that kind of thing. But
thanks.
It's far enough in the future that humans have kind of diverged, and there are people who live outside of the gravity well of Earth, and they've sort of become sort of slender and have less sort of like bone density, and... Mm-hmm. And there's just like, it's all a political intrigue about who gets resources and, you know, who provides them. And there's all sorts of weird assassinations and alien.
This is my college biology project. And
oh, there you go. Yeah. Yeah. So, hey, read the Expanse series.
Good to know. You guys missed that. You weren't in that class. You didn't miss
it. We were not.
Wait.
It was bad. We had to do a group project on something. About science, and we chose
that was it. That was the whole parameter.
No,
it was an entry level biology course.
It was an entry level biology course. She was trying to get us to do something scientific.
She was a history major, man.
To a presentation on the divergence of human species and transhumanism and what that might look like, and it was a disaster.
Wow. Well, it's a fun idea. Yeah.
Ambitious, but rubbish.
Yeah. Very ambitious rubbish. It ended with one of our group people standing up there saying, I think we should abandon the scientific model completely when thinking about this.
Oh, boy. No. That's what you want to say in a science class.
Uh-huh. And then I looked at the professor's face, and that was when I knew we are not going to get a good grade on this assignment.
I don't know. How committed are we to this whole scientific method thing?
I was going to say, what you should have done is got one of us, the philosophers in there, to argue about how the scientific method really is a matter of faith.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to die. You're killing science. Well,
yeah, science.
The person who said that was that we should abandon the scientific method for some sort of mathematical theory that I do not remember.
That's also the science. It's also science. Math is science. Math. Do they know that?
Science is faith.
Are they okay?
The professor at that point gave us points because when we got to that point, like, all the rest of the group members were like, oh no. She saw the looks on our faces and realized that we had no control over what had just come out of our teammate's mouth and gave us pity points.
Yikes.
I love group projects.
No, you don't.
I hate group projects. That's why I do a podcast by myself.
Well, thank you for coming onto our group project.
Yes.
That was a lot of fun.
Ours is a group project, but we try to give everybody space to do their thing, too.
We also tend to just make science do all the work.
Anyway, Jared, thank you for being on our show.
Oh, thanks for having me. That was a lot of fun.
So if you would like to tell us how you, a millennial, are ruining biblical reading by only going for the Vulgate, or would like to tell us about how you like this episode, or inform us about the weird nature in your backyard, then please email us at theliberalarts@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you to Tristan from Vintage Loud Tech for our theme song, and to Caitlin Thompson for our graphics and design, and to Jared for coming on the show.
Next time, I'm going to give you guys my philosophy of mythology, because I can't talk about one without talking about the other.
I don't know what
that
means.
It's going to be good.
And it sounds cryptic, and I'm into it.
It's going to be good. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah. And, Jared, where can people find you on social media, and what would you like to promote?
They can find me at Crypto Nature on Twitter. I do have a Crypto Naturalist Facebook. Or you can find me at thecryptonaturalist.com.
And on podcatchers near you. It's good. Give it a listen.
Until next time, learn something worth knowing. There you go.
Yay!